be synthesized very briefly and succinctly. He is a professor of Persian language and culture at the University of Maryland, as well as a founding director of the Roshan Center for Persian Studies. He has been instrumental in establishing that extraordinary center there. And we are exceedingly happy to welcome him here as a visiting faculty, not only this year, but for future years to be, hopefully, and maybe even have the pleasure to absorb him entirely, not letting him go back to Maryland. He has published greatly, and it's almost indecent to say the numbers, over 100 articles, and way more than I really like to admit, books on the subject, above 20 books. It is really indecent of you to have published so much. Many of you have encountered these books, these articles. I'm sure that many of you know this important book, Recasting Persian Poetry, that has almost canonical prestige among academicians, both in Iran, India, and the Western universities. It has become a standard theoretical book on the subject of Persian poetry and is widely utilized for PhD exams everywhere. So just to give you a token of the immense production of Professor Karimi Hakkak. He has also contributed greatly to many important encyclopedias, be it the Encyclopedia of Islam, Encyclopedia Iranica, and others, and Britannica as well. Articles that have become standard loci of for all of us to consult initially on subject matters of Persian literature. And I think that I have done a good job introducing you. So I think that I would then, without further ado, invite him to the podium for his talk entitled Dynamics of Continuity and Creativity, Models of Change in Persian Poetry, Classical and Modern. Please welcome him to the podium.
Thank you very much. You have done an excellent job of creating and continuing the tradition of exaggeration, which I appreciate very much, coming from you. It is really an honor and a pleasure to be here. In more than one way, I have been to this university many times, have never stayed for long. This time I'm staying for a substantial amount of time. I have never seen the center, Iranian studies and various related fields as much thriving as they are now. And so it's with genuine pleasure that I accepted Professor Shahriban's invitation to deliver this talk. I have no doubt that I will be leaving this podium much enriched myself, not just because of his erudition and wisdom, of which I've been a beneficiary for years, but especially now that I can sometimes catch him in the hallway and get him to talk to me about, particularly about the relations between pre-Islamic Iran and Islamic Iran and so on and so forth. But also because we have a tremendous guest among us, Professor Parvaneh Pourshariati, a wonderful friend of mine and friend of everybody, and someone who is tremendously instrumental in helping our understanding of the dynamics of continuity and creativity in Iranian culture, and so many other colleagues that I will not name, but they know I'm beholden to them for so much. We all are. It's a discipline, and as a discipline, we read each other's work. I wonder if anyone else does, but we do read each other's work and are enriched by them. You may know that, unlike many of my colleagues, I have not elected to specialize in a period in Persian literature. This is a huge literature with a glorious past and a thriving future. Instead, I've decided to concentrate on the theme of change. At this time, towards the end of my career, I'm working on a multi-volume work on the history of Persian poetry, the crown jewel of Persianate cultures, over the past 1100 years at least. And as such, every talk that I give, I use a chunk of it primarily to learn from my audience. And I expect no less today. So let me begin by telling you what I plan to do and how I've organized this lecture. I really would like very much to put into conversation two moments in this history, in the history of Persian poetry. Two moments separated by over a millennium. One moment is, of course, the moment of the gestation of this tradition. In Central Asia, towards the end of the 9th century, beginning of the 10th century, when a group of poets, scholars, scribes, supported by some courts who were bent on establishing some sort of sense of identity that's different, that would be different from that which was emerging and developing in Baghdad, that is an Islamic culture, now in their realm, Khorasan, the greater Khorasan, in the Persian language rather than the Arabic language. So that's one moment, late 9th through the 10th century, when a group of poets did whatever poets do to give this language, the Persian language, a poetic status, which it did not have before. To do so, they relied heavily on the resources of Arabic literature, the Quran. But they also created many works, among whom the most famous is the Shahnameh, which itself became a fountainhead of this tradition. So in a way, when I was reading some 40 years ago, Eric Auerbach's Mimesis, and he talks about the emergence of Western literature as on the base of two fountainheads of Iliad or the Homeric, the Greek Homeric tradition on the one hand, and the Bible, Old and New Testament, on the other hand, I was thinking a similar situation exists in Persian. When this Persian appeared in the 9th century in Central Asia, Balkh, Bukhara, Samarkand, and those cities, it relied not just on the Quran, but also on the Shahnameh and the myths that had been canonized through the Shahnameh. So that's one moment. That moment is gone. Over 1,000 years later, in the early 20th century, there emerged a group of what I've called new intellectuals in Iran, now the center and heartland of Persian literature, who tried to institutionalize Persian literature. They imagine yourself in the early 1930s, the moment of the establishment of Tehran University. And imagine men like Isa Sadiq, the Minister of Education at the time, or Ali Asghar Hikmat, a great educator, or Muhammad Ali Furughi, their chief. He was really, after all, the prime minister of Reza Shah. These men, looking back at that moment of gestation, did things with it. So I would like to see how they interrogated those men of 1,000 years previously to develop their own idea of how now, with the benefit of Europe as their model, to study this literature. This literature had not been studied in the way that it began to be studied at Tehran University. Previously, of course, there was the Tazkiret tradition, there's remembrance of poets, organized geographically, historically, in terms of genres, and so on and so forth. But to submit them to what modern understanding they had of literary analysis, of how literature is to be studied, how subjectivities operate in those contexts, creates a dialogue that I think could be a good point of beginning to explore the relations and the evolution of literature over time. So when these men, the founders of Tehran University and the founders of the Danishkade Adabiyat wa Ulum-e Insani, the Faculty of Literature and the Human Sciences, the translation itself is interesting because you can translate as Letters in Humanities or Literature and Humanities or Literature and Human Sciences. There's a lot of room for various conceptualizations of what literature is and what human studies, human sciences are, and how does one study humanities, because it did not emerge in Iran. It emerged, as you know, in Western Europe during the Renaissance. So when I look at those two, I see advantages and I see constraints. They had the advantage of really wanting to speak rationally about literature, not as poets themselves, not as poetic enthusiasts as such, as in the previous generations, but as interrogators of that tradition, as people who examine that tradition and try to tell us things about it, preserving their own subjectivity. There were similarities among the two groups, the modern scholars of Persian literature, and the tradition of scholarship that has been going on now for about 100 years, 80-some years at least, but as people who want to study it in terms of academic disciplines. So you have to periodize. And how do you periodize Persian literature? How do you work its changes through time? And also, in terms of constraints, one idea that emerged was this notion of sabks. Literally, it means style. It came to mean period styles. But what happened was they spatialized, that is, they conceptualized these as spaces. So they came up with terms like sabke Khorasani, the Khorasani style, or the Khorasani period style, or Iraqi, which really means Western Iranian period style, or Indian, which means in this subcontinent, because of course Persian poetry was appropriated in India as well, and Indians contributed to it tremendously. Or later, because it appeared to them that the Indian style was foreign, exotic, not quite in line with what their perception of what Persian literature should have been, they also posited a bazgash, a kind of return supposedly to the original fountainheads, that is, the Khorasani period, or Khorasani, or late Khorasani, early Iraqi period. And of course, various other terminologies that we now can question. So the third moment emerges is us, scholars of Persian literature, having now had much more with the benefit of Western thought. And remember, literary studies, literary theory has made tremendous advances, strides forward in Europe. And we, many of us, are familiar with at least one of those traditions. And through that tradition, we have access to theorizing literature. So how does it work? Both the Samanids, the early, late 19th century, 10th century, 9th century, 10th century poets and scholars were patronized and supported by courts. Courts which themselves were bent on establishing some sort of identity, although that identity was far from being a nationalistic identity. Nonetheless, the 20th century people, looking back, thought it was nationalism. They thought it was as they would have it in the 20th century Iranian nationalism. So in the process of submitting this tradition, this glorious tradition, to critical readings, first of all, they gave us wonderful things. Remember, up until the 19th century, when you said Persian literature, you were not talking about research library from here to there, PK books. You were not talking about those. These books emerged first in India in the 19th century, Chapasangi lithograph, and later in Iran and elsewhere in Chap Sorbi, and now, of course, in computerized ways. So they gave a body to this spirit. They gave a body to this tradition, so that you now have a definable Persian literature that deals with works coming from Iran, from Afghanistan, from Tajikistan, elsewhere in Central Asia, from India, definitely, and is in the Persian language. That was not the impression that 18th century people or 12th century people had of Persian literature. First of all, there was no system of communication. Hafez or Saadi both talk about the Shahnameh or the personages of the Shahnameh. Yet, we don't know what they mean when they say Shahnameh. They certainly did not have a book within two covers called Shahnameh Hakim Abul Qasim Ferdowsi. They knew tales. They didn't know which tales were in the Shahnameh. They also had Shahnameha, as Sa'di says, in ki dar Shahnameha avardan Rustam o Ruin tan Isfandiyar ta bedanan in khodavandan mulk az basi khalq ast alam yadigar. So there's that tradition, but But it's first of all is mnemonic. It has been memorized. It has been copied. It has been selected. And in various ways, people know here and there who said what when and what it might mean. But they did not have our systematic, institutionalized, and embodied understanding of Persian literature. So when you put these two together, I want to see how, when these early 20th century scholars interrogated those late 9th century, early 10th century poets and scholars, what would they hear back? They didn't have anything but the texts, of course. And that is why, ladies and gentlemen, I have made it my lifetime mission to write a history of Persian poetry that is text-based. I am sick and tired of all the generalities and generalizations about Persian literature that deal with everything except for literature. They deal with the life of the poet, they deal with the kings and the patrons and so on and so forth, but you hardly ever get any line of poetry analyzed. So bear with me while for the next 40 minutes or so, I walk you through some texts. Notice, for example, my handout number one. This is an excerpt from a ghazal by Rudaki, which I call Live Joyfully. Shad ziba siyah chashman shad ke jahan nist jos fesane bobad, and so on and so forth. And I've spared you the knowledge of Persian for this purpose, so I've put everything in my translation. Mind you, these are not adorned translations. These are tool translations. That is, they're there to facilitate my analysis rather than give you the pleasure of reading work of literature. So, live joyfully with black-eyed beauties. Live joyfully. The world is no more than legends in the wind. Thinking of the future, you should rejoice. And for the past, you ought to have no care. Myself and that musk-scented, curly-haired beauty. Myself and that moon-faced beauty. So, what... That's why in the flyer I call it a kind of joie de vivre. It's a worldly tradition. It's a worldly tradition of live life for the pleasures of it. Of course there's death. Of course life is short. Of course all this. But we are the poets and we are associated with the courts and they serve wine and socialization go together. And so this is a lively tradition. Or when they're not drinking wine, they're actually looking out in the world. Pupak didam be havali sarakh, Rudaki says. So the world is the arena of their observation. They make observations about the world out there. The world is beautiful. The world is ephemeral. Life is too short. But you have to carpe diem, seize the day, and live life to the fullest. You see a lot of this sentiment there. You also see, of course, ubi sunt. The theme of Ubi Sunt, where are the those of yesteryears? Of course, you know, there are dead people and you wish they human beings could live forever and ever, but you have to reconcile yourself to the death, the demands of life, okay? So that was by Rudaki of Samarkand, and the date it bears is somewhere in the early 11th century. His years are 960-1040. The second handout, it's a full ghazal, and I give it full because it's about wine, and I knew I enjoyed myself, and I knew that Professor Shayegan will enjoy it too. So, Ahmad Shabo as khab mara ranjo azab ast, ay dost biaran ke mara anche mara daruy khab ast. So here is the assembly, an assembly of ahrar, and that's a very pregnant word right there. Free men, not just free from the pain of labor, but free from the din of society, free from the hubbub of the marketplace, and so on and so forth. Early Persian poetry, ladies and gentlemen, is very elitist, and it remains elitist, although there are pretensions of it being accessible to everyone, but it's not, it never has been. So if you're a plebeian, no one expects you to know poetry at that time. Now, of course, we expect you because you come to a university, right? So you have to be exposed to this literature. But notice that this man is celebrating wine not to get drunk, but because this means sociability. This brings him into a kind of assembly, a kind of class that is very select supported by the king. Death is there, of course. But so what? There's death. من جهد کنم بی اجل خیش نمیرم. Of course, my time will come and I'll die. But I'm not going to welcome that. Nor am I going to destroy my life or ruin my life in prayer or whatever it is. These are Muslims, mind you. But they're very liberal Muslims. They drink their wine, but of course, you know, they maybe also occasionally pray or something. They find ways of accommodating both tendencies. In a word, I call this an afaqi kind of poetry. That is, external, outworldly, dealing with the world as it is, trying to come to terms with it. Through the 12th century, ladies and gentlemen, I'm not saying this is the only reason, but primarily because of the sway that Sufi monasteries begin to hold, that tendency changes. People veer towards within. And this is seen in the texts, mind you. And I have written about this extensively. For example, I have an article about Simorgh, which is why the picture is on your flyer. Simorgh, for those of you who may have met this character in the Shahnameh, Simorgh is a nurse. She, and I call it she, there's no indication that it's female, but you know, let's imagine that's female. She's a healer. She is a seer. She doesn't know everything, but what she knows well. And above all, she has a body as big as 30 birds, which is what the name means. Some of my students think morgh means chicken. It doesn't. It means birds. Okay. So this is a body, a big bird, if you will. Now, cut the Shahnameh and move to the Conference of the Birds, and you will see this etherealized. The Simorgh in the Conference of the Birds, Attar's work, a century later, a century and a half later, is not a body. It is a presence. It lives in the Qaf, a mythical mountain. No one sees it. No, none of the birds that make it there see her or him. It's a kind of godlike figure. So that's one way this poetry begins to be interiorized. That's my term for it. It begins to veer towards the interior. Poets ask themselves this. Rostam kills demons and dragons. Who does Sheikh Sam'an have to kill? His own lower self, nafs. And my question to you is, whose challenge is greater? Is it easier to struggle against demons and thieves and dragons and so on and so forth? Or is it more important to improve your nafs, your inner self, and try to be a better human being as they understood it, okay? So in this thing, what happens in the text, and textually, the first major poet to do this is Sana'i. And he has this poem, which I'm going to read for you. It's only three lines. You will hear many tales about Jamshid's cup. And in each, this is your handout, number three in your handout. And in each telling, something added or left out. Know this for certain. Jamshid's cup is your heart. The seat of joy and sorrow is your heart. When you desire to view the world, you can see all things inside it. He is doing a tremendous trick on us. He is turning an outward image into an inward image, because Jamshid's cup was a real cup or ball or crystal ball. People looked into it and they saw the state of the world, okay? Reflected, maybe flames of war, maybe prophesying war, as Coleridge would say, or whatever they saw, it related to the outside world. Now, what does it mean when a poet comes and tells us, Jamshid's cup is your heart? Now, not only says it, but wants us to believe it. Be yaqin dan. So, qisse jam jam basi shenavi, bandaran bi shakam basi shenavi. Be yaqin dan ke jam jam dil tost, mustaqarr surur o gham dil tost. In doing so, Sana'i is changing the terms of seeing. There's things that we see with the eyes of our head, and there are things that we see with the eyes of our heart. And that in itself is a big part of Islamic mysticism or Sufism. So what he's doing, he is inviting us to think of seeing differently and imagine our heart as that which shows us the state of the world. So it has to, you have to go in to go out. The way out is the way in. That's how you understand it. So, and he says it with iqan, with kind of belief, with certitude, with religious certitude. And he said, مُسْتَقَرِّ سُرُورُ قَمْدِلِ تُوَسْ, because we feel it in our heart. Sorrow is in our heart, and joy is in our heart. So why not conceptualize the sorrows and joys of the world through the workings and the state of our heart? Look inside, look into your heart, as Shakespeare would say. So this becomes a tremendous gathering force that changes Persian poetry a lot. I'm trying to think my way through this change, because when we come to the next change, it is going to be a kind of more obvious change, because the shape of the poem on the page and the sound of the poem in your ear begins to change. Here, that one doesn't. The generic divisions remain the same. The outer trappings of poetry remain the same. But what changes is the inward turn that poetry takes. And I'm not saying that's only because of the rise of Sufism. I have identified at least four different trends that contribute to that kind of a change. So let me give you a count of it. The first one is the change of the ghazal, the Persian ghazal. In the early period, there's taghazzul. The ghazal is not an independent genre. It's part of the qaside, and it takes an inward lyrical turn when the poet, addressing his beloved, begins to express his love for her, or for him, or whatever it is, I don't know. There's this huge noise about, was the beloved in Persian poetry male or female? I don't buy the whole discussion. I think it doesn't matter. It's gender, it's all gender included. There's the lover position, and there's the beloved position. And that's very clear in the poetry. So who cares whether it's male or female? The positions are very clear. The lover's sight is the sight of need. The beloved's sight is the sight of needlessness. میان عاشق و معشوق فرق بسیار است. تو یار ناز نماید شما نیاز کنید. Because your job, you lover, is نیاز کردن. Is to display your need for her or him. Her job is to reject you. Of course it is. Because it's love and it has to last forever. That's why we see love age in our system, because maybe the beloveds do not nose enough. Do not play the coy, coquettish lady enough. Anyway, so the addition to the Persian ghazal of the man, god, and poet patron gets a third dimension. In the early ghazal, there's man and god. There is lover and beloved, or there is poet and patron, and there's an exchange amongst these pairs. Okay, here what you get is an etherealization of the love relationships itself. No longer, as orthodoxy around them would tell them, no longer is the relationship between man and God fear, organized by fear. It's organized by love. And they read the Quran in this way. In the Quran, there's this idea of the Ruza Alast, that is the pre-eternal day when God created man. And on that day, God first makes the clay of human beings, Adam in it, Eve is in it, you are in it, I'm in it, everyone is in it. Because they all, it's one mass of clay. And at that time, God addresses that mass of clay before breathing his spirit in it. And he says, Alastu barabbikum? Am I not your master and Lord? Qalu bala, Sana'i says. They said yes. And that becomes a covenant, Ahd-e Alast. That covenant of Alast is unconditioned. You are bound to God in the same way that, Christ is you are Christ in Christianity. there's a union already, but there occurs a separation. So when God, when Adam transgresses, he's kicked out of heaven, and the fall happens. And now you have a choice of either going the path of religion, do your prayers and fast and do all of the things and so on and so forth. And at the moment of death, you'll have to wait under the earth for who knows how long until the day of judgment. That's the Orthodox narrative. The mystical narrative is, be a good mystic, you die, you go immediately, ascend to the presence of God. There's no waiting. There's no waiting room. There's no waiting. So it becomes a very attractive deal for if you're a believing person, a person of belief. So that kind of turns many of the assets of Persian poetry towards the interior. And I will see examples of that if I have the time. One other thing that happens, Nizami happens. He's a poet occupying most of the 12th century, a few years, 1209 is his death, a few years into the 13th century. And he's separated from Khorasan. He's sitting in what's today Azerbaijan, in the city of Ganje, and he is writing romances. And he looks at the romances before him. Fakhruddin As'ad has been there, and he has written the Vis and Ramin, and the same darn pattern happens. There's a love at first glance, long separation, maybe a reunion, maybe in this life, maybe after your death. And he makes romances along those lines too. So literature begins to track the way of the narrative of the mystics. The whole idea of mystical understanding of God takes over for close to 700 years. The final thing, but the most important one, is the way mystically inclined commentators of the Quran interpret the Quran. In Orthodox Islam, you have to believe that every surah, in every chapter, and every verse in every chapter has equal value. It would be irreligiosity if you said this verse is more important than other verse. And yes, yeah, and yet the Sufis did exactly that. And they elevated certain of the verses. Notice this one. Ghazali has his field day with this in Mishkat al-Anbar. I'm giving you only the English translation, but here I've got it designed because I don't want you to understand the depth of my ignorance in Arabic. So I will not read it in Arabic. Go to handout number 4. God is the light of the heavens and the earth. The parable of his light is as if there were a niche, and within it a lamp, the lamp enclosed in glass, the glass as it were a brilliant star lit from a blessed tree, an olive, neither of the east nor of the west, whose oil is well nigh luminous, though fire scarce touched it. Light upon light, God doth guide whom he will to his light. God doth set forth parables for men, and God doth know all things. Isn't that a tremendously beautiful thing? Notice how loaded it is with all these things, the five kind of stages and all ways of interpreting. The notice there's, and I'm going to read this part because I don't want to butcher it. Ghazali begins his plunge into the esoteric by distinguishing not just between light and darkness, but between a physical or terrestrial sphere for light on the one hand, and a spiritual or celestial sphere on the other, distinguishing many gradations in each sphere. According to him, in the above verses, human faculties or spirits find their correspondences in the niche, the glass, the lamp, the tree, and the oil. The niche is the sensory spirit, whose lights come through the eyes, ears, nostrils, etc. The glass is the imagination, for it is made of opaque substances, but is clarified and refined until it becomes transparent to the light of the lamp. The lamp itself is what can be called the intelligential spirit, which gives cognizance to divine ideas. The tree is the rational spirit, which typically begins with a single proposition, that's the stalk of the tree, and branches in two, which become four, and so on and so forth. Ghazali then works through the series of equivocations that apply this complicated conceptions of light to the Quranic verses. What is symbolized by the niche, the glass, the lamp, the tree, the oil, are the human faculties. The niche being sensory spirit, the glass, the imagination, the lamp is the intelligential, and the tree is the discursive. As for the oil, he sees it as the type of transcendental prophetic spirit, absolutely luminous and clear, which reveals the word of God to human beings. And this is where he works towards his Insan al-Kamil, the perfect man, which in his idea, Muhammad was. And he was kept in a shaft of light for millennia until the time came for when God asked him to profess his mission. It's an amazing work these guys do on these things, on these verses. This doesn't apply to every verse, because some verses are simple commands. Do this, do that. And notice that other the idea of Ahd al-Ast, this is number 5. When thy Lord drew forth from the children of Adam, from their loins, their descendants, and made them testify concerning themselves, saying, am I not your Lord? Alastu barabbakum? Who cherishes and sustains you? They said, yeah, we do testify, lest ye should say on the day of judgment, of this we were never mindful. That becomes the basis for Sana'i saying, as baray yek bali kan dar azal gofte ast jan, ta abad mard bali an dar bala oftade ast. So calamity, disaster, misfortune is our fate, because we bought it from God. It's part of the covenant. So in this way, these people really try to interiorize everything in the sense that, and this is a way of a power grab as well, because the same station that kings had before, now the Sufi masters assumed. So it's not quite a noble humanistic thing. I'm a materialist, and I don't believe in any religion. But this is exploiting religion for their own purposes. This trend culminates in Hafiz, I think. And I have a ghazal by Hafiz that unfortunately I have to leave for you to explore yourself, which is really about, deals with centrality of love, and not only the centrality of love, but also what happened on the day of Al-Asr. As you see, it's an action-packed kind of day. All kinds of things happen. And this is your number 9. I'm jumping to number 9 because I want to bring this to a close, if I may. But let me tell you one other thing that Hafiz does. He also, and Sa'di does the same thing, more or less the same thing, and many other mystically oriented poets, whether they are civil mystics, that is those who are trying to use the assets of mysticism to make better human beings in society, and those who just retire from the society and become balandari and malamati and so on and so forth, and become almost antisocial. Notice numbers 7 and 8. Hafiz says, Shah Turkan sukhan muddaiyan mishanavad sharmi az mazlame khun siyavushash bad. In English, in my poor English, that says, King of the Turks listens to the words of false pretenders. May he or she feel shame for the injustice handed to Siyavash. Okay, who knows the story of Siyavash here? As you may know, what happens is Siyavash, who is the son of Kaykavus, leaves Iran and goes to the enemy territory, Turan, and shows his superiority to everyone else there. And Afrasiyab, the king's brother, his name is Garsivaz, starts feeling jealous. And he starts bad-mouthing him to Afrasiyab, saying he's planning a coup against you, etc., etc. And eventually, Siyavash is killed. So some injustice has been done to Siyavash. The Shahnameh leaves it at that. It's an outwardly, external text that wants to draw our attention to the world and what happened in the past, you know. That's the theme of the Shahnameh. Here, Hafiz, that's not Hafiz's agenda. Hafiz is talking about himself and his beloved. And when he says King of the Turks, it can mean Afrasiyab, but not really. And when he says false pretenders, he's talking about those people who said nasty things about Siavash to Afrasiab, but not really. He is drawing all of the assets of the external texts into his own realm, bringing them. I call this emotive distillation. He distills them and drags emotion. And the emotion that he drags out here is shame. Shame on Garcivaz. Shame on my beloved who listens to false pretenders in the same way. So the narrative pattern is set aside completely. Only the internal meaning of the text remains for us to ponder. In the next one, again, I'm giving you a single line. ما قصه سکندر و دارا نخوانده ایم از ما به جز حکایت مهر و وفا مپرس. He's lying. He has read it. And we understand from this line, because the story of Iskandar and Dara, Alexander and Darius, is the story of Kin and Jaffa, of hatred and animosity and all of that. So where he says, "As ma bejuz hekayat mehr o vafa mapors," meaning, I do not see the world as suitable for animosity and for hatred. I am conditioned by love. Ma qisse Iskandar o Dara nakhondim. As ma be juz hekayat mehr o vafa mapors. We have not read the narrative of Alexander and Darius. Ask us not, but the tale of love and loyalty. Because love and loyalty is the opposite of those other things. Now, this brings me close to the end of my talk. I have only two more handouts that I'm giving in full ghazals for you, because I want to take a jump all the way to late 19th century, and how once again the same assets that were taken to the recesses of the poet's heart and mind are now being moved into the public square, this time within the context of a country of Iran. So a country of Iran has been formed. It's been there since the Safavids. Remember, there was not much of Iran as a country, as a political unit, between Qadisiyye, that is the defeat of Yazdegerd's army in the hands of Arab Muslims, and 700 years later, the sack of Baghdad, 1258 or whatever. And it was only during the 14th, 15th century that some inklings of a new Iranian identity came to be seen. And Pur Shariati has written about this, and so has Muhammad Tawakkuli Tarqi and many others, and I have used their models. So within that context, now these people are pondering how Persian poetry can be made relevant again. Exposure to Europe has destroyed the kind of insularity that Iran had, and you know, considering itself the center of the Persian-speaking world and so on and so forth. And now, notice, there are two ghazals. One is by Muhammad Baqir Khosravi, a grandson of Fath Ali Shah who lived in the late 19th century, and he writes a ghazal, and here's the opening lines. Garam chah hast andar rah to, ya dar, ya har do, vagar sar mi ravad barbad, ya دستار یا هر دو زبانم یار میگوید روانم یار میجوید تو خواهی مست پندارم یا دیوانه تو خواهی مست یا دیوانه ام پندار یا هر دو. About 25 years later, 1910 about, Lahuti writes a ghazal in the same rhyme, یا هر دو, and in the same meter. Here's his poem. وطن ویرانه از یار است یا اغیار یا هر دو، مصیبت از مسلمان هاست یا کفار یا هر دو، همه داد وطن خواهی زننده با نمیدانم وطن خواهی به گفتار است یا کردار یا هر دو. Of course, you know the similarity of the thing. It's a whole tradition of اقتفا and استقبال and so on and so forth. It's an intertextual relationship that he's establishing with Baqir Khosravi some 50 years previously, but his is about a country of Iran and its ruinous condition, and how the majlis and the bazaar and everybody is a traitor, and no one cares for the country. So his arena is not the love relationship between me and you. Garam chah hast andar rah to, ya dar ya har do. His thing is, who is ruining Iran? Who is to blame for the wretched, sorry condition of the country? So in this time, the assets of the Ghazal, the Qasideh, and everything else are now moved into the public square and tied to the social, political, historical condition of the country. What I'm trying to say, ladies and gentlemen, is Persian poetry does not have a single fixed spirit. It has a history. A lot of scholars before me talk about the spirit of Persian poetry. That spirit is a changing entity. A lot of scholars do not necessarily take issue with what I've said, but they do it from outside in. I want to put text in front of me and go from the heart of the text all the way back to whatever surmises I may have. So I want to write a history of Persian poetry that is text-based and that extracts its evidence from the text itself and generalizes to the extent possible. I do not wish to generalize from the dynastic relations. There's no difference. There's no evidence for us to think that Hafez changed because Amir Mubarizuddin was killed, he was a bigot, and Amir Shah Shuja became king, who was much more permissive. There's no evidence. We're just reading that into it. So when I talk about the early 20th century scholars interrogating the tradition of 1,000 years previously, I'm saying they have not done a good job of it. They have written another history of Iran, dictated and dominated by political history rather than by cultural history and poetic history. I'm saying there's all this evidence, there's all these texts for you to agree or disagree with me, but this has to be our approach. And we cannot continue writing histories of Persian poetry without any poetry, history of Persian literature without any reference to stories and plays and so on and so forth. They then begin to interrogate the next change, that is the change from the external to the interior, the process of interiorization. And there, they become religious all of a sudden. It's as if everyone became more religious than they were before, which is not borne out by the evidence. Then they cover another agenda that they have is they want to appropriate all of Persian literature, which is multi-ethnic, multicultural, all kinds of, you know, diversity, a very diverse, in fact, a universal heritage. They want to confiscate it and appropriate it in the name of the new country of Iran. So Sana'i is from Ghazni, but he's given to you as a poet of Iran. Ghazni has nothing to do with Iran, never been part of Iran. Masood Saad Salman is from Lahore. It's now in Pakistan, it used to be India. Doesn't matter. Because Persian poetry has got little to do with this or that geographic unit. Persian poetry is an international, multi-ethnic, ethnic tradition that we have inherited. I was in India, and there I came across the Bahmani dynasty of 200 years, 13th to 15th century, and at least 12 poets who were Buddhists or Hindus, but wrote and whose mother tongue was not Persian, but they wrote in the Persian language, because this was the lingua franca of the whole of Western Asia, at one time covering more territory than the Chinese language. So what I'm saying is, we are dealing with a tradition of academic achievement, but also great constraints that have been placed on us. And as one scholar who is heir to the nationalism of early 20th century, but has departed from it in his own mind, I want to restore that multi-ethnicity to it. I want to restore that international spirit to that heritage. How I'll do it, I still am not that sure, but I know I want to begin with this process of institutionalizing Persian studies, institutionalizing Persian literature, and have that tradition walk it back to the 15th century, to the 12th century, and to the time of Rudaki, the 11th century, and see where evidence leads me. Thus far, I'm very happy with the evidence that I have been able to gain, and I think that it's in this way that we can have a history of Persian poetry that is neither nationalistic nor distorted, that is cosmopolitan, that is international, and that in every way it's a heritage of many, many generations of human beings. Thank you very much.